We have got to spend the time in the connections to build the relationship first before we can ever begin to do any type of evangelism and then discipleship.
Hi, I'm Carl Vaders, and welcome to the Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. In this episode, my guest is Sam Peters, and we'll be talking about the microchurch model. And more specifically, we'll be asking what are the minimum aspects we need to have before something can be considered church. So if you're serving in a small church, especially if you're in a small church that's in crisis that might be considering whether or not there's a viable path forward, this will be a helpful conversation. The microchurch model is worth considering, and Sam offers some help for thinking about it in some fresh new ways. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with a few thoughts about what to do if you're a small church that's wondering if your congregation has a viable way forward in ministry. Well, Sam Peters, welcome to the Church Lobby.
Thank you. Good to be here. It's been a minute since I saw you last.
Yeah, it's been a little while, but we've stayed connected because you've really been writing some good material and creating some great stuff for bivocational pastors. And I wanted to talk to you today because you wrote an article it's actually a long one. What it reminded me of was like old school journalism where they would have in magazines where they'd do like a long form article that's almost like half a book. And it would, you know, those are the ones that were always nominated for a Pulitzer or whatever, these, you know, long ones. And this is a long article with a lot in it, all very, very good. So I wanted to spend some time. We're going to talk about the ecclesial minimum and the future of micro churches. Both of these concepts are of interest to me. But before I think micro church is something most people know. We'll talk about it in a bit. But ecclesial minimum might be a new term for a lot of listeners. So yeah. What does that term mean to begin with?
Well, I'll give you a little background about where I came up with it. Just prior to the pandemic, I sort of had this vision of creating some, at the time, we weren't sure what to call it. So we were calling it online small groups. And I was trying to get my arms wrapped around a way to define that because I wanted it to be different than the way we've used that term. And as I began to ask a lot of my colleagues and some experts about those types of things, I couldn't find anybody that really could talk coherently about what I would come to know as microchurches. And I finally connected with an individual by the name of Brian Sanders down in Florida. And he was running something at the time that was called The Underground. And I went down, and by the time I finally managed to arrange the trip, COVID had hit. And so I went down there during the pandemic, which was challenging in and of itself. And I sat down with some of his leaders and sort of kind of presented what I saw and absorbed what they were telling me about what micro churches are and this ecclesial minimum. And the ecclesial minimum basically revolves around three very simple facts that I think the pandemic pointed out to us perfectly. And that is that there's three things that make up the ecclesial minimum, and that is worship, mission, and community. And where those three things overlap, church is happening. And we probably didn't think of that prior to the pandemic, but I think certainly during the pandemic, we learned that, hey, we could have church without an organ, even without hymnals, even without a church building. We could have church in a lot of different ways and formats. In fact, some of the best church stories I heard happened on people's front porches as groceries were delivered and conversation was had and prayer was taking place. And as I saw it, Carl, that was church to me. And so I think the pandemic really proved that out. There were those three things exist. You certainly can have more, but those are the three minimum things that I felt like you needed to have to say church was happening.
Right. So when we're talking ecclesial minimum, we're not talking about a minimum number of people. We're talking about the bare minimum aspects of what we should be doing as a church.
Exactly. Yeah. What are the things that we have to have? Because you can take any one of those things out. Right. And all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a civic organization or a government organization. But when the three things overlap, suddenly it becomes something very unique and almost divine in a way.
Yeah. I'm looking at the three now: worship and community without mission. That's a Bible study. Worship and mission without community. That's a family. I mean, I guess you could just literally within a family. And mission and community without worship as a community organization is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. If you take any one of those three out, you're really not talking about church. So for church to be church, we're not talking about building. We're not talking about numbers of people. We're not talking about budget. We're talking about what are the things that Jesus called us to do. And when we gather, you know, I am among you and this is church. And those three things come together. So you then say that this once we kind of recalibrate our understanding away from the church, away from an organization, away from budgets and buildings towards these three aspects, then it lays the foundation for micro churches.
Right.
So how does that lay the foundation for micro churches and define for us what micro church is? I think most of us have a general idea, but it's always good to define it.
Yeah, let's start with the definition of what micro church is. At least my definition. I found out a lot of people have different definitions,
yeah.
But again, it's where these three things come together. And instead of church being a place we go, it's a thing we do. Church becomes a verb instead of a noun. And so that can happen anywhere. That can happen in a coffee shop. It could happen at the golf course. It could happen on a hike. I've got some great friends that have a great, what I consider a micro church going on, and they hike on a regular basis. And you know, there's worship and there's community and there's mission and there's an open invitation for unchurched people to come. And so that's a wonderful thing. So microchurch can have a lot of different definitions, but again, it includes that ecclesial minimum. Again, take one of those out and it's not really a microchurch. Yep. It's just a get together. You know, kind of taking a look at that and how that might evolve in a movement, particularly in small churches, as you and I connect with on a regular basis, it's ways of doing church relationally. And it's one of the things that I feel is really going to be, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about discipleship right now.
Right.
But not a lot of people are talking about evangelism. And I really think evangelism and discipleship is best done relationally. It certainly was in the book of Acts. So I think it's done relationally. And I think we need to get back to that. And so as that relates to smaller churches, I think smaller churches do it better than anybody. I mean, it's a relational organism.
Yeah.
That's really all it's about. I mean, yeah, we have some structure and we might have even, you know, some rules that we follow, but by and large, smaller churches are relational organisms of people that are, and I've always said, it doesn't matter so much what name's above the door.
Yeah.
It's what's going on with the church family that happens inside the doors. And so it's that relational aspect that attracts us to it. Well, we're taking that relational aspect now, and we're moving it beyond the walls, and we're saying we're going to do something beyond the walls that connects more with our community in a relational way, in a way that's more organic, more authentic, so that we can kind of break down some of the barriers of the people who really aren't coming to our church services on Sunday mornings.
Yeah, I think because we've had a couple conversations about micro churches here with various guests on the Church Lobby. And one of the parts of the conversation that always seems to come up is this generational shift that in my generation, boomers and even Gen X to a certain degree, but now it's fading with millennials and Gen Alpha. There is less of an attraction to the institutional and corporate, even to institutional and corporate excellence, let alone to the institutional and corporate forms, and far more openness to a more organic and more intimate smaller expression, especially in faith. And I think in part because of whether correctly or incorrectly, a lot of the recent scandals of the church are connected to the institutional church more than they are to the idea of just gathering as God's people in a more intimate setting. In fact, you mentioned that when we embrace the ecclesial minimum, we can, here's the quote, these minimum churches can reignite their purpose, maximize their impact, and thrive in ways that larger churches simply cannot. And then you go through four things that the microchurch model allows smaller churches to do. So let me give them to you one at a time. And if you give us some conversation about it. So first one, the microchurch model enables smaller churches to, one, stay laser focused on disciple making.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those things that, in fact, when I got your book on desizing the church, I went to Discipleship Fixes Everything was the first chapter I read. I didn't start at the beginning. So, I read that before I read the rest of the book, which is a great book, by the way. Because disciple making is what we're supposed to be about. And smaller churches are as guilty as this as mega churches.
Sure.
We've gotten into the business over time, and I don't think it's intentional, but I think we've gotten into the business of being more focused on keeping up our buildings and our decades old activities and ministries rather than being about disciple making. I had a great conversation with a group of pastors, a mentoring group that I meet with on a regular basis. And we were talking about these issues of disciple making, and several of them pointed toward the pandemic and said, well, you know, the pandemic just killed our disciple making. And I said, can we just be honest in the room and admit we were bad at disciple making before the pandemic? So
the pandemic just exposed the cracks.
It just put a big spotlight right on top of it. So, I think particularly in the area of smaller churches, where we're just trying to find something we can hang our hat on. And I talk a lot about this in my upcoming book on One Excellent Mission, but we're looking for that one thing that we do better as a smaller church in our community than any other church. What's the one thing God has uniquely knit us together to do? Well, when it comes to disciple making, there might only be a couple of ways that a smaller church is perfectly suited to do that. And so by clearing away all the clutter that's not necessary and getting down to this micro church and this ecclesial minimum concept, it allows a church to say, what's the one thing that we could do to make disciples right now? And and it just really clears up the fog. This is what we're doing.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, because it's smaller and because it's, in fact, micro, I've found multiple times as a pastor, even in a smaller congregation, but large enough to be considered an institutional church, so much of my time was spent doing things that I'd get to the end of days and go, I didn't do one thing today that I feel like I was really called into ministry to do. It was facilities, it was meetings, it was schedules, it was all the other stuff. And the ecclesial minimum and the micro church, it's like, if you're not doing the essence of ministry, there's nothing else to do.
Yeah. Let's get through the jungle, get down what we're supposed to do.
It's that or nothing. So that's the first one. The second one is it helps us to meet people where they are.
Again, one of the great things that I discovered, I published a book earlier this year called Rebuilding Stronger, and it's got a long subtitle, which is, you know, navigating the post-pandemic landscape of worship. And so we don't worship today like we did in 2019.
Right.
The landscape has completely changed. And one of those things, again, that really came out to me was the church began to behave like the church again. We were meeting people where they are, again, on front porches, and literally picking up phones and calling people, not texting them, but phoning them and having conversations. It's beginning to build relationships with people again. And once all the rules were lifted and we could actually meet people and have less than a 6-foot distance between us, people went out to eat together again. They had coffee again. And all of a sudden I saw this resurgence, particularly in the small church, because the relationships were always there. We just didn't realize how important they were until we couldn't have them. Yeah. And then we missed them. And we said, I got to get back to that. And so we're having coffee with people. We're going out to lunch again. We're saying, listen, we got to go see a movie together. We've got to get the kids together and have a play date. All of a sudden, there was this connection that we had taken for granted. And it came back.
Yeah. Well, either that or on the other side, there were people who realized they didn't really miss it because they hadn't really been engaged in it. And so there was nothing to miss. Right. And again, it exposed the cracks. It exposed the churches that had strong relational bonds that people missed. And it exposed the churches that didn't have strong relational bonds so that there was nothing to miss. In a lot of the teaching I was doing immediately near the end of and then post-COVID, I saw a whole lot of that. It was one of the, I actually did a teaching on it, some of the primary differences between churches that survived and thrived during and after pandemic and those that didn't. And that was one of those things, was those that had the strong relational bonds came back to them.
Yeah, I consulted with a lot of churches and I saw some of those too. That was some of the lessons, like, you know, what lessons have you learned from those who just really struggled coming out and how many of them thrived?
Yeah.
And it boiled right down to those. You had a vital church with health and good relationships, or you didn't. And if you didn't, you're struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. Number three, then, is that helps to mobilize every believer as a participant in God's mission.
Oh, yeah, haven't you missed that? For so many years, even as a bivocational pastor, so many people in the church, they were passive consumers of the Sunday morning worship service, and they were not active participants in the mission. And one of my struggles, and I guess one of my frustrations, was trying to get people on board with that. And you always had your 10 to 20% of the people that got it. You know, they were, you know, yep, what do we need to do, Pastor? I'm in. But 80% of them were just, they were just passive consumers. Getting a church to buy into this ecclesial minimum and getting into a micro church movement, you still might only have the same 20%. But what's going to happen is it's going to begin, and I think organically, it's going to begin to spread to some of the other folks who've been on the sidelines passively watching. And when they begin to hear the stories, and I think stories are so important for smaller churches to tell, because you get three or four pastors together and it will be 5 minutes before someone's going to say, hey, how many did you have Sunday? Right? Mm-hmm. We got to get back to where we're telling, you know, stories about where God is moving. And when people begin to hear that, and when we celebrate that, whether it's in our Sunday morning worship or within the micro churches themselves, other people, it's catching. Other people want to be a part of that. You know, they want to be a part of that mission. And I think that's probably a dream of every pastor, is that we'd love to have every person involved in God's mission of making disciples.
Yeah, absolutely. The meat of the article, you explore four different aspects of it. I don't want to make most of the rest of our time together on these four pieces that you explore. And I'll give, well, the three, sorry, not four, but three. And let me give everybody all three, and then we'll take a look at them one at a time. You explore, first of all, what the ecclesial minimum means in practical terms, which is, for most listeners, okay, tell me how to do this. Secondly, how microchurches operate and why they are so effective. Like, if it's an alternative, what's the point? And then thirdly, how smaller churches can transition into the mindset and embrace a new model for disciple making. So listeners, if you are interested in the ecclesial minimum, what that means, what microchurch means, is that a valid alternative for the congregation that you're serving or for where you want to be going into ministry? Maybe you're in between places of ministry. Maybe you're wherever you are. These are things that are going to be some really practical steps. So let's take a look, first of all, in that, what are the components? Well, we've talked about the components of the ecclesial minimum already, worship, community, and mission. But let's take a look at the next piece, and that is what the ecclesial minimum means in practical terms. So talk to us about that. You even have a side-by-side of the ecclesial minimum versus the traditional institutional church. Give us a couple highlights of that.
Yeah, just a couple of those. One of the things that I think is important, we have to explain this. If you're a pastor and you're listening to this somewhere down the road and you hear this, oh, I'm going to do this on Sunday. Don't, please don't do that. You have to spend the time building the foundation with your church about what the ecclesial minimum is and what micro church is. But basically, one of the things that I think is key is that you begin to get your congregation to understand that worship can really take place anywhere. In home churches, and we had a lot of that happen during the pandemic, in coffee shops, in parks, even in workplaces on lunch breaks. And I think that is so critical to understand, is that because, again, in these small settings, first of all, they're nimble. They're not nearly as orchestrated as maybe an institutional church might be. But relationships are the heart. You know, when you begin to build a relationship, you build trust. And when you build trust, then you build a bridge then for people when they have a spiritual question to be able to ask you. And that's where the evangelism piece comes in. And I think when you look at the traditional church, and I don't want to get too much into this aspect yet, it's real hard to do when you have all of these structures and programs in place. It's not nimble. Mm. You know, it's this big ship that takes a long time to turn and steer. And so I think worship is a key thing here. And probably secondly, and this is key for me because I'm big on leadership and building new leaders. The late Stan Toler, I don't know if you've ever met him, but Stan Toler was a great leader expert and worked with John Maxwell quite a bit. He asked me one time, we were having lunch, and he said, Sam, who are you training right now to be your next leader? And I said, well, I don't have anyone right now. He said, then you're not a leader. Leaders are always training their next leader. And so for me, leadership, I think, is an important component, because what it does is it allows maybe people you didn't even see as a leader to begin to rise to the top in these micro churches as leaders and begin to find their place based on their own spiritual giftedness, that they can communicate and connect with people in a way in certain settings that they would never do on a Sunday morning. So that's one of the things I think is key too. And And again, it's so flexible. I had heard a great story when I was down in Florida. They created this micro church that reached out and met with some people that were homeless and displaced. And they found in this micro church that they started, there was a subset, maybe 8 or 9 people that were in this group that were all out of work and displaced musicians. And so they spun out of that another micro church where they found a music studio that donated time for them to meet, work on their music, worship together, and pray together. And so because this thing is flexible, as God begins to lead, you find other little micro churches. I spoke with a group, I say a group, two different couples that were struggling with foster parenting and adoption. And they wanted to start a micro church for family, and it was going to be an online micro church for families that were going through the same struggles so they could support one another. So that kind of flexibility gets you beyond the organizational structure that we tend to have in our institutional churches and buildings. It gives you that flexibility to say, where's God leading right now? What's rising to the top? What felt needs do we see? I had a colleague of mine tell me a long time ago, she said, when you find your misery, you find your ministry. And I think sometimes that can happen better in a micro church setting than it can in the institutional church.
Speaking of which, you have a piece in the middle of the article, The Limitations of the Institutional Church in Reaching the Community. And I found it really interesting, but it's something that I want to talk about in our bonus material. And I'm saying all of this, and I've spent my entire life in ministry in the institutional church, not in the micro church, not in the house church. I just realize every type of church has its upsides, has its downsides, and I want to be able to talk about all of these
Sure.
freely and openly. So one of the things I think is important for us to understand is those distinctions. So we'll do that in the bonus material. So listeners, if you are interested in a separate conversation about the limits of the institutional church in reaching the community, we're going to do that. And if you want to listen to the bonus material, there's an easy couple easy ways to do that. First of all, anybody who supports this ministry financially can get the newsletter for that in addition to a whole bunch of other stuff. You go to karlvaders.com/support, become a monthly supporter. You'll get all the links to all the bonus material plus a whole bunch of other cool stuff. If you just want to get the links to the bonus material for this and other podcasts, you can get that for free by going to karlvaders.com/subscribe. So either one of those will get you that. And we're going to take 5 to 10 minutes to talk about some of the limits of the institutional church in reaching the community. Again, not because the institutional church is bad. I'm involved in one, but we need to understand the pluses and minuses, I think, on both sides. But you do then spend some time talking about why micro churches are perfectly suited for mission. We talk about mission being one of the three of the ecclesial minimums. So you go through several points, I believe it's four or five, four of them all together. Let's walk through those,
Sure.
why micro churches are perfectly suited for mission. The first one is this: relational discipleship. Faith is shared through deep personal connection.
Well, you touched on it a little bit earlier, and that is that there's this in the Gen Zs and the Gen Alphas, there's this growing mistrust of institutionalized church and organized religion. And there's this growing rate of what people have termed the nones, people that have, no religious affiliation. And so taking a look at that, when we start talking about, well, how do I reach them? Well, if we still think this is 1950 and all we need to do is open the doors on Sunday and people will come, we've missed it completely. What this allows us to do is, again, get into a point where we're building relationships. And we're boomers. I came from an era where on Saturday mornings as a pastor, I went door to door on Saturday morning, knocked on doors, introduced myself, and evangelized. Okay. That's how old school I am. But relational evangelism is more of a long game. We have got to spend the time in the connections to build the relationship first before we can ever begin to do any type of evangelism and then discipleship. I had one gentleman, loved him to pieces. It took me 4 years, and we found a common interest in old classic cars. And that started the relationship. And 4 years later, he slipped me a note one Sunday morning and said, I'd like to talk to you about how to receive Jesus Christ. It took 4 years to get that job done, but it was worth it,
Yeah, absolutely. But number two then is community integration. So we're talking about relational discipleship now, community integration. You say that micro churches can go where mega churches can't. Tell us about that.
I think in this case, smaller is better. I think sometimes when you're that large, I mean, you can do big service things, and you know, I know churches, they'll do like change the oil on people's cars on a Saturday, and got all these people will come out and do that. But sometimes I just want someone who wants to sit down and hear me over a cup of coffee. And it's hard to do that in a larger setting. I think being able to, and by the way, a little side note, I'm not talking about reinventing the wheel. Sometimes it's a smaller church coming alongside another church, another organization, whatever, to meet these needs. But sometimes just having two or three people that get together and finding out where the felt needs are is a lot easier to do than having a big mission push from a larger church. And again, I'm not knocking larger churches. I'm just saying smaller churches are more nimble. Right. We can turn quicker. We can adapt quicker. Yeah. We don't need to have a board meeting to decide I'm going to have coffee next week with these two people.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out for the pastors who are in a struggling small church, you're talking about a healthy small church, ideally, because we all know there are small churches where you can't adjust the thermostat without having a board meeting with everybody present.
Exactly. And I probably pastored some of those churches in my past.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking a baseline of health here, but you're right. When you're dealing with healthy, comparing healthy to healthy churches, the small healthy church should be much more nimble. Before we continue, I'd like to take less than a minute to mention three important items. First, if you're new to this podcast, it's a product of helping small churches thrive at carlvaders.com. We provide encouragement and resources for pastors of the 90% of churches that aren't big through workshops, books, articles, this podcast, and more. Second, our current project is to raise approximately $20,000 to help us conduct small church pastor workshops in Indonesia, Malaysia, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany in 2025, including translating and printing one of my books, The Grasshopper Myth, into the Indonesian language to give for free to 1,000 small church pastors. The churches that need our help can typically afford it the least, so if you'd like to help us do this, you can support us at carlvaders.com/support. And third, you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter and get all the latest resources and news at carlvaders.com/subscribe. Links for all of this will be in the show notes. Now, back to my interview. And then the third one that you mentioned, I think, is one that at least occurs to me on a kind of a regular basis. When I think about the microchurch, here's one of the things that I think about: flexibility and scalability, that we don't have the burden of large facilities. You know, I've been serving my congregation now for 32 years, and for a good 20, 25 years, well, a solid 20, I was frustrated on a daily basis by the small size of our building, that it was limiting growth, because that was one of the church growth mantras: was you can only grow to 80% capacity of the size of your building. And this building was very small, and so it was limiting our growth. And then it was during COVID and during recent downturns where I'm watching a whole bunch of congregations that are in a church building of that seats 300, 400, 500 people and now have 30, 40 or 50 people. And now we're realizing the blessing and benefit of the smaller facility that doesn't have so much upkeep, that doesn't have a mortgage anymore. And that, of course, is one of the primary benefits of the microchurch: is you don't have that burden. That too often we equate the church only with the building. And when you remove the building, you get to focus a little more on mission, and you don't have the stuff that's pulling your attention away, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things that I wish more smaller churches would focus on, that, particularly in the microchurch movement. We get so caught up, and I made an impact statement in that article, where we prioritize programs over people and maintenance over mission, and it needs to be the other way around. By being able to get into this microchurch movement, you may find yourself as a church really playing more of a support role for all of these microchurches that have, you know, birthed themselves from your church, and you've got a lot more going on outside your walls than you've got going on a Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully so. Hopefully so. Which leads us to the fourth advantage: that in a smaller, and especially in a micro church, you're going to have a much higher percentage of your members that are mobilized and have and go from passive to active. And this just simply, the way I like to express it when I'm teaching other pastors, is I tell them, I reverse engineer it. And I think if you want to be a passive watcher of the church, what size church are you going to pick? you're going to go to a large one. It's easier to be passive and anonymous. Yep. But if you want to be active in a church and if you want to have impact there, you're typically going to choose a smaller church because you can make those connections much more readily and you can be a part of the body of the church and they're going to miss you when you're not there. So talk about how the micro church is a more, the word automatic isn't the right one, but a much more natural place to be active rather than sit and passively observe what others are doing.
Well, I think one of the things that I've realized in the churches I've been working with is it bridges generations, particularly in smaller churches. I see so many of them with average ages of 70 and 80 is the average age of the congregant there who feel like their usefulness in ministry is already gone. And they want younger people to come in to do what they used to do so fervently and can no longer do physically. But in a micro church, just using the giftedness you have is enough. God's able to take our loaves and fishes and multiply those in ways that we couldn't have even fathomed when we were sitting back just being a passive absorber of the Sunday morning worship service. I've got some great friends that they've embraced this concept. And I'm in Ohio, okay? So we're big Ohio State fans in this state, okay? So just to let you know. Mm-hmm. And they do a tailgater every Ohio State game. And they have begun to invite all kinds of people from the outside just to come in and be a part of the tailgating. And through that, they've been building relationships that in turn have led open doors for them to invite people to Sunday morning worship. So, and again, these people, they're in their 90s and doing this. Yeah. And so that's one of the great things that I've seen is that people can take the giftedness they have and they can use it in a way that they feel like a disciple maker again. They feel very active on a very, very much a part of what the church is doing.
Yeah, terrific. You get at the end of it, this is, I want to get to the point where for a lot of pastors who are listening, it may be the main thing that you're going to come into this for. You walk through six steps of how smaller congregations can transition to the microchurch model. We've emphasized microchurch in the podcast several times over the past year or so, because I really believe that for a whole lot of smaller churches, survival is going to depend on transitioning to microchurch. Yes. That for a lot of small churches, I was with a pastor friend of mine a couple of years ago when we drove into a particular county, and he said, he started talking about this county, and I'm going to get the numbers a little bit off, but it's pretty close. I think he said the county had something like 35,000 people in the entire county. And he said, and we have 55 churches here. And I said, 55 churches, like of all denominations? He said, no, just 55 churches of our denomination. Woo. And he was like, we can't sustain all of them. There, these churches were built back in the day when people walked to church or they took horseback to church or they all got in the carriage and, you know, where horses pulled them to church. And so you needed a church, you know, just a church is just a few miles apart because they were all designed to serve small groups of people who could not go long distances. Mm-hmm. The world has completely changed. He says, we probably only need about half of that right now to very easily serve the people that are here. And we certainly cannot maintain all the buildings and the structures and the staffing for institutional churches for 55 churches. And that's just the one denomination and it's Bible Belt. So there's hundreds and hundreds of churches of other denominations serving that group of people. So obviously there's always going to be people who aren't going to any church and there's always room for more. But when the structure requires the keeping of a building and the paying of a full-time pastor and staff and electricity and all of that, then very quickly, that's where the lack of sustainability comes from. Not because there are people who need Jesus, but because the structure becomes unsustainable. So if you're interested in making that shift, with that, which I think a whole lot of small churches need to much more seriously consider than we do, let's take a look at the six steps that you've got laid out. Right. Step number one, shift the mindset from church as a place to church as a people on mission.
Yeah, I think this is probably the biggest task any pastor or church leader has to do first. It's so ingrained into our being about what church is, and it's a place we go to on Sunday instead of a church as a people who are on a mission. And so a pastor has to spend a lot of time shifting that mindset, first of all, to where people are more mission-minded instead of just, again, being a passive consumer. And so I would encourage every pastor, anyone listening to this that thinks, yeah, I'd be interested in moving that direction, you're going to have to spend some time explaining to your congregation this concept, this mindset that you have to have to go to micro churches. And you've got to help them understand God has uniquely knit us together where we are today in this place, in this community, to do a certain thing. And just sitting here on a Sunday morning for an hour, 2 hours is not it anymore. How do we reach beyond that? And so you've got to help them. Again, don't go in next Sunday and say, I'm going to make a change. No, it's going to take a while.
Yeah, I mean, shift the mindset is a sub point of one point in an article. And quite frankly, we could use volumes of books on how to shift mindset because that's the challenging one. But that's where it has to start, from churches placed to people on mission, what we do, not where we go. Secondly, you say start small, launch micro church gatherings within your existing congregation.
One of the things you have to have is you have to have a policy in these micro churches that there's always an open chair. Anybody can come. And so once you have that, then you can say, listen, why don't we have some people? Let's get together at my house. I'm going to have a barbecue, or let's get a group. I've got a group of men that I meet with once a month. We just get together for coffee. And, the conversation always starts out with where are you seeing God at work in your life right now? Those kinds of things. And so starting small, you don't have to, reinvent the wheel. Just find two or three like-minded people that want to get together for fellowship and worship and to build community, and that are willing to let other people come into the group. Even the smallest church can find two or three people that could do that. Find a way to start small and just see how God moves in that capacity.
Yeah, I'm a real fan of the early easy win.
Oh yeah, low hanging fruit. Always pick that.
Yeah. What are a couple things you know you can succeed at, or you have a pretty high likelihood of succeeding that? And then when you have a record of success, the harder ones become a little bit easier. Third point then is reframe leadership, empower every believer as a disciple maker, which we've really, touched on already, but give us just a little more on
Well,
that.
one of the things that I've noticed, Carl, over the years is, particularly in smaller churches, you have somebody that's been doing a particular ministry or a particular job. It might be a song leader, Sunday school teacher, small group leader, whatever it is. And they've done it for so long, no one else wants to step up and say, I feel God calling me into that area. But, I'd like to try that. I'd like to be mentored into that, And so people just sit back and they wait until someone, either leaves the church or dies before someone steps up into that role. Well, in micro churches, what you're doing is you're kind of giving this new fertile ground and opportunity for people to grow and flourish in. And so you might find, again, people have some gifts and some assets that they've been kind of keeping on the sideline because they didn't want to speak up, they didn't want to step in anybody's toes. And so it's a way for folks to find new ways to be, again, active in ministry, maybe step into some leadership roles. And it gives them the empowerment to be a disciple maker. You have my permission to talk to people about Jesus. It's okay.
Yeah, this is a big shift, and people need to be guided carefully, relationally, and step
Sure.
by step. And then number four is integrate mission into everyday life.
Yeah, I think this is huge, Carl, is that too many times folks, it's like they punch a time card on Sunday morning. I'm in, I did my hour or 2 hours on Sunday morning, and God is an afterthought the rest of the week. When they shift their mindset to being a disciple maker 24/7, then all of a sudden, casual conversations at the water cooler become an opportunity to maybe hear somebody say something and say, is it okay if I pray about that for you? Whether it's okay to do it on the spot or sometime later, but is it okay if I pray about that for you? It gives us an opportunity then to let that mission be a part of everything we say and do and where we go and where we shop and all of that.
Yeah, I want to get to number five now, because this number five feels, these other ones have a philosophical underpinning, which are important for us to understand. We've got to start there. But then in number five, you get to some real nuts and bolts stuff. Number five, transition the church's structure to support micro church growth. And this to me is one of the biggest shifts outside of the philosophical underpinning, is a restructuring of the way we do everything. How do we begin to structure from institutional church toward microchurch?
It's actually one of the most difficult shifts to make,
Yeah.
because again, it's so ingrained in us to take care of the building and the structure and all of
Right.
that, that seeing the church itself, that as we've always known it, now as a support player and not the main player. As my role is that I, you know, let's say it grows and I've got 10 microchurches that maybe are meeting with 200 people a week in various capacities. And on Sunday mornings, I have my little 40, 50 people that meet for Sunday morning worship. The big building and the church there is no longer the main thing. And so that the church has to shift it, the way it thinks, into being more of a support structure and being able to say, how can I help you, microchurch? What can we do to support what you're doing because you're making a difference? And that's a real shift, because so many times, and this has been one of the struggles I've had with churches that I'm working with. You maybe start a few microchurches and all of a sudden you get people in there say, well, when are they going to start coming on Sunday morning?
Yeah.
When are they going to start giving?
When you described that structure, that was my first thought, was there's going to be a bunch of people that are going to step up and go, okay, wait a minute. You got up to 200 people going to the microchurches during the week, but only 40 are showing up on Sunday. Those were the numbers you used. And my first thought was, I know there are going to be a whole bunch of people within that 40 going, well, when are the rest of them going to show up for real church?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the big, and you have to accept the fact that they are going to church. Begin by our ecclesial definition, they're in church every week. They're just not here with you. Yeah. That might not mean that someday some of them might filter in with that, but that's not the intent to do this. It's to make disciples and win people to Christ. And if we realize that that's the real mission, and not to have X number of people sitting in our pews again, and X number of dollars going into the church coffers again, now we're back to mission.
Right. So then the sixth step for this adaptation from small institutional church model to the micro church is to get to the point where we can multiply and adapt over time. What you say is that the beauty of the micro church model is its ability to multiply naturally. So talk to us about that, because institutional churches do not multiply naturally.
No, it's too hard.
No,
but
yeah.
What you, and again, I'll relate back to the story I told earlier about the group that was down in Florida that found out there was a subset of musicians in the group.
Mm-hmm, right.
What you see happening as it begins to grow, you begin to see other ways, subsets of people that want to meet in a different way or a different location. They want to start a house church. They were meeting in a coffee shop, but they've got some friends from work that they want to invite over, and all of a sudden they start meeting on a Sunday. Well, they don't need to go to two micro churches necessarily. So at some point in time, it just makes logical sense that I'm going to start a new house church over here, or a new coffee group over here, or book club or whatever. So it just sort of comes, again, this is where the organic process, I think, comes from, Charles, that we begin to see as we build relationships and get to know one another, there's other needs that rise to the top. There's other ministry ideas that spring forth. And it may not even be with our group, but it might be two or three people says, you know what? I know there's this group of people over here that I would love to connect with. Okay, well, how do we do that? And that's when the big institutional church steps in and says, and how can we help you do that? Can we make copies of flyers for you? can we financially support that for you? You know, and again, that's getting the institutional church into the whole church planting mindset. But we're not planting another institutional church. We're trying to plant 5, 10, 15 micro churches.
Got it. Well, as a reminder to the listeners, before we get to the lightning round, we are going to do a separate bonus material. It'll be on the YouTube channel that you have to get a link to go into. So if you're interested in us talking about the limitations of the institutional church in reaching the community, go to karlbaders.com/support, become a monthly supporter, and you'll get all kinds of free material, great material from that, including the links to all of the bonus material, or you can get just the bonus material. You can get that for free by going to karlbaders.com/subscribe. But before we let you go from this main podcast, and again, we've had so many conversations about microchurch, there's so many places that we can go with you on that, but we'll just leave it where it is right now, whet people's appetite. And again, I really encourage the average small church pastor whose church is struggling and trying to figure out how do we even stay viable, seriously consider the microchurch model for that. So let's get to the lightning round questions, though, before we let you go and into the bonus material, Sam. Question number one is this: what are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years, and how have you adapted to them?
Well, I think particularly for small churches, and the pandemic really, again, just floated this right to the top, live broadcasts and online meetings. being able to connect in so many different ways. I was an early adopter of a lot of those tools. And I, you know, my first thought was, how can I use this to make disciples and connect with people beyond Sunday morning? But it's also expanded into, I have groups of pastors that I meet with. We do Zoom calls, we do online meetings, and we're able to encourage one another, even though we're apart by many miles. So yeah, I would say not only seeing that, but adopting that. You know, I also know a lot of pastors, man, as soon as they could get back together in person, anything they were doing online got kicked to the curb. And I think that was a mistake.
Yeah. The both and, I think, is way better than just the one or the other.
Yeah,
absolutely. Second question, what free or cheap resource like an app or website has helped you lately that you would recommend for small church ministry?
Maybe a couple here. The first one is a thing called, it's an app called Linktree.
Yeah.
Linktree is it's a free app for a small church. Doesn't cost you anything, but it allows you to have a mobile app for both communication and connecting. So if you have an online Bible study, or you have videos of your Sunday sermon, or you just want to put a church calendar out there, or maybe you've got a sermon manuscript or whatever, you can put those out and put links out on Linktree, and people can access that. And we always put a QR code in the worship guide so people could scan it and get to Linktree right away. And probably second to that, one of the tools that really helped me as a bivocational pastor was starting to utilize some of the AI applications, because I was writing all my own Wednesday night Bible study material. Well, we were actually on Wednesday nights, we were using the Sunday morning sermon as the Bible study material and just doing a deeper dive. But I could take that entire sermon and plug it in and say, create an outline for me. And we just use that as our talking points. Some of it didn't fit, but that was okay. I could say, nah, scratch that. We're not going to do that one. But man, it saved me hours of time each week in writing and thinking that as a bivocational pastor meant the world to me.
Yeah. It's not good for creating content, but as a research assistant, it can be really
absolutely
helpful.
Yeah. Just a bunch of material. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you on Linktree too. Our church uses it and my ministry uses it. So when I'm at a conference and I direct people through the QR code, if you want to find out more, it's to the Linktree because you can change it really quickly. So you can be having a conversation. Somebody in a Q&A asks a question and you can say, hey, there's an article about this. And I go, you know what? I'll just drop it into our Linktree. When you scan that QR code, it'll be the third tab down or whatever. So it's like a mini website that can be an on-ramp to anywhere that you really want to take them.
Exactly. Yeah. And great. And again, I like the fact that you can just use the free part of it, free application.
Yeah.
So every small church can afford it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Number three, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
Years ago, I was associate pastor to a senior pastor. A fella came in furious about something that was said in the service. After the service, slammed his hand down on the desk and started berating the pastor. And Pastor Jack never flinched. He just sat there, listened to every bit of it. And then I got to hear a master's class on conflict resolution. And Pastor Jack called it feel, felt, found. And after this guy had just said everything, he says, you know what? I know exactly how you feel. I felt the same way. And here's what I found out. And then he just completely dismantled. In the end of it, they were hugging and everything was all great. And
wow.
I'm just like, oh, I was like 23 at the time. So this was like, oh my goodness, this is great stuff. And so it doesn't always work, but it does help in a lot of conflict resolution.
Yeah, it's a mini script, but it doesn't feel scripted when you say it.
Yeah, and you know, you can change the words, but it's getting like people want to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know you heard them. They want to know that you relate to them. And then you need to find a way to segue to an answer, a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so feel, felt, found was something that Pastor Jack taught me when I was in my 20s, and I've never forgotten it. It's probably the best piece of advice I've ever gotten. And the second thing is more from personal experience. Every pastor should have an accountability group or a mentor. No pastor should do ministry in isolation. I did that for a while in my 30s in a church plant and found myself so burnt out, I just wanted to lay on the floor and not move. And I learned the lesson of self-care in that. And I was fortunate enough to have another senior pastor recognize it and said, let's go golfing Saturday. I want to talk to you. And I learned a valuable lesson.
Yeah, hugely important. And if statistics are true, and I believe they are in this one, most pastors do not have anybody to whom they're accountable.
Especially in a small church environment.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody who will comfort them when they need comfort and someone who will rebuke them when they need rebuking. We all need that in our lives. Finally, number four, what's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
Well, I had someone jump up and shout and run around outside the church building hooping and hollering one time. I just kept preaching. I didn't worry about it.
Did they even claim that it was the Holy Spirit? Or
yeah, they did. Just... Yeah, they just jumped up and woo, and off they went. Run around. First they ran around all the pews, and then they went outside the door. And I every now and then I'd see him go past the windows, you know. So he eventually came back. But probably the weirdest thing, back in 2015, I did a sermon called Waiting. And it was based on Psalm 27:14. It says, be brave and courageous, yet wait patiently for the Lord. And a pastor colleague actually gave me the PowerPoint for this. So I can't claim I originated it, but I saw it. I thought it was powerful. I used it. But it was basically, it was an animated PowerPoint slide that went on for 4 minutes and 30 seconds. And I never said a word. And it started out, had things on the screen. It says, we hate to wait, don't we? Waiting leaves us wondering who's in control. What's happening? And then some words came up that says, for some of you right now, the waiting is killing you, and you'd do anything for me to say something. And it, what felt like 30 minutes was actually only 4.5 minutes before I ever started my sermon. And people said it was one of the most impactful messages they ever had. They said, can you do more sermons where you don't talk?
So. I did learn that lesson early on in counseling. The less I talked in counseling, the better counselor I was. But I'm not. I never took it into the pulpit. So yeah, that would
you can
be,
only use that sermon once, though.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Hey, if anybody wants to follow up on any of this, especially information about microchurches, how can they find you online?
I've got a website called smallchurchcoaching.com, and there's all kinds of ways to connect with me there. I'm on Facebook, just as Sam Peters. I've also got a leadership group called the Leadership Edge for Smaller Churches. And you can find that also through my website. And I'm on X and all the other stuff too. So look around. I've got some books out there and stuff. You can find me. I'm out there.
All right. Terrific. We're going to go into 5 to 10 minutes on the limitations of institutional church and reaching the community and the bonus material. We told you how to get it. You can find it in the show notes as well. But thank you for your time on the main podcast today. Thank you, Sam, so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I reflect back on my conversation with Sam, I keep thinking about so many of the churches in crisis whose pastors I've talked with recently. One of the most commonly asked questions is, how do we stay viable when we can't seem to get enough people in the church to pay basic bills like the mortgage, the lights, a pastor's salary, and so on, let alone be able to finance any outward-facing evangelism and ministry? And the only answer in many of these situations is that we have to ask hard questions like, how badly do you want your church to survive and thrive? And what are you willing to do to make that happen? Are you willing to even consider something like a microchurch model? I'm not saying microchurch is the answer for you, although it might be, but what I am saying is that if you and the church leaders are not willing to even consider something that radical, your hopes for a strong future are actually very low. The world around us is changing in good ways and bad ways. On the bad side, an average-sized congregation, which is about 50 right now, is not very likely to be able to support the finances of an institutional church model the way we used to, a building, a salary, and so on. The good news is that people, especially younger generations, are more open than ever to being involved in a strong, healthy, biblically sound church that may not look like the church that you or I are used to. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.